So the New York Times owns up to its historic anti-Semitism, and an interview with a woman who's written a book to help deal with transgender issues among kids.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to today's Line of Fire broadcast. Michael Brown here, delighted to be with you. 866-348-7884 is the number to call. We've got a really rich broadcast for you, and it is going to start with, well, some fascinating updates, a confession from the New York Times, and then something that was brought to my attention today when the New York Times first reported on Adolf Hitler. Obviously, we always say hindsight is 20/20, being able to look back and see the monster he became, but amazing to see their initial report. And you'll see New York Times goes back decades and says that this still hangs over our head the way we reported on the Holocaust. We'll talk about that. And at the bottom of the hour, I'm going to be joined by Denise Schick. She has written a children's book, I'm holding it in my hands, When Daddy Leaves to Be a Girl. It is a book to help children deal with transgender issues from a Christian biblical perspective, something she lived through firsthand when her dad confessed to her at what, the age of 9, that he really believed he was a woman. All right, let's start here. I want to give you an update from True News, and I'm just looking for, I've got a screen down, so I'm just looking at something that I sent out earlier on my computer here. So True News, Rick Wiles, I've accused them of anti-Semitic comments. I've challenged things they've said on the air. As soon as I did, I copied them, and they said, hey, great, come down, come on our show. And I said, in a heartbeat, but I would like Rick Wiles to come on mine as well, to be fair. And if not, then why don't we publicly debate the issues with moderators and all of that and do it a right and fair way? And they didn't get back to me, And they finally said, we don't want to debate. And he wasn't going to come on my show. And I should rebuke Ben Shapiro for blasphemy. That's what they said. Of course, I wrote an article about that. Well, I decided, with the ugliness of some of what they've said, with things getting so out of hand, with what we're seeing in the society around us, the ugliness of it, the rising tide of anti-Semitism, like I've never seen in America in my lifetime, and some of it coming from professing Christians, which I've documented for decades, but seeing it on a shocking level now. So I had my assistant, Dylan, reach out again to our contact at True News, and I said this, tell them I'm willing to come on their show without Rick Wiles coming on mine. I want to address their anti-Semitic comments. And here's all I'm asking for, that they guarantee me equal time total against their panel. So if their panel is going to talk for 10 minutes total, I get to talk for 10 minutes total. And that I've written guarantee that the show will be edited, it will be aired in an unedited way so that people get to see our actual conversations. He doesn't have to come on my show. I'm willing to go on yours. I'll go on your turf. Thanks, but no thanks. Maybe another time. So I just want to let you know. I said, I'll just go on your show then. The issues are serious enough. I want to address them, rebut them, hold their feet to the fire for what they're saying. Let's see who is speaking truth and who is not. And they wouldn't do it. I'm just letting you know. I went the extra mile, joyfully, gladly. And right now the door is slammed in my face. So, and we won't believe you unless we see the email. I'll gladly post the email exchange from Dylan and the gentleman at True News, who's one of their panel members that I've taken issue with. So that's a fact. That's truth, what I just told you. So if you respect True News, say, hey, why don't you have Dr. Brown on? He's saying what you're saying is false. He's saying he can rebut it. He's saying he's got facts on his side. He wants to challenge the facts on your side. If you love True News and respect the people there, urge them to have me on. I'll do it. They don't have to come on my show. We don't have to have a formal moderated debate. I just need in writing a guarantee that there'll be equal time. And so their total panel time, I get the same time. And the other thing, that I will be able to have the show go out in an unedited form. Is that too much to ask? Nope, not willing to do it at this point. So just letting you know. Okay, so let me just find this here. Okay, nope, that's not it. Here we go. Just want you to see a recent comment that was posted. We get these constantly. Here's the good news, friends. Here's the good news. As we are calling things out, okay, I'll come back to, yeah, Kai, leave that comment up from Valid Core, okay? Number one, we're getting this day and night, but I'm glad to see we are bringing the anti-Semites up to the surface. Because the ultimate anti-Semitic lie is this. There is no anti-Semitism because all the charges against the Jews are true. They're evil. That's the ultimate anti-Semitism. To deny there is any anti-Semitism because what? The Jews are so evil. So, and of course, I am a paid agent. A secret, you don't know how many times he's an Israeli agent. He's a shill. He's Mossad. He's this, he's that. Well, someone tell my bank account that if I'm working for all these people and all the Jews are so wealthy, how come we don't see it in our bank account? So how about this one? All I hear is the pathetic cucking of a Zionist shill prostitute or a Zia shill prostitute. How many shekels are your blank master, so derogatory comment there, tossing at your feet for you to continue to grovel and shill like this. So when I speak the truth, when I give facts, information, rebuttals, comments, etc., when I do that, all right, this is what we get. So here's the good news. I'm glad because it's bringing the ugliness up to the surface. So Valid Core, Israeli News and Lies would be a much fairer debate since both of you are Jews. What happened last week? You challenged them after two shows, and now Stephen says you won't return his invitations. We haven't gotten an invitation. I have a full-time personal assistant. We have staff members, one of whose jobs is to answer all emails that come into our website. We have been waiting for an invitation. Why is it that everybody else is able to contact us? Why is it that the media day and night is getting interview requests to us? Why is it that others, people want to sit with me and talk, normally I'm not able to do it schedule-less? Why is it everybody's able to get questions to us? Why is it that we have team members whose whole job, a New Testament scholar and an Old Testament scholar, their whole job is to answer all the questions you send in that I can't get to? Why is it that everybody else can get to us, and yet we haven't received an invitation yet? I am waiting for it. Waiting for it. All right. Let's take a look at the New York Times. I think it's important. This came out yesterday. This is the New York Times, which has been caught over and over and over again in biased reporting against Israel and biased reporting against the Jewish people. And just last week runs an op-ed in which the guy references Jesus being a Palestinian. And I and others raised voices against that. And then they published a correction at the end of the article. Oh, sorry, editor missed that. Of course, Jesus was a Jew born in Bethlehem, and what were we thinking, kind of thing. So for them, this is the title of the article, A Rising Tide of Anti-Semitism. By publishing a bigoted cartoon, the Times ignored the lessons of history, including its own. So the New York Times is taking responsibility, not just for what it did now, but for the past. So I want to read some of this to you. The Times published an appalling political cartoon in the opinion pages of its international print edition late last week. By the way, a few days after that, they published another one in the international print edition, another anti-Semitic cartoon. Remarkably enough, it's like while I'm apologizing to you for losing my temper and pushing you, I punch you in the face. It portrayed, the cartoon portrayed Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel as a dog wearing a Star of David on a collar. He was leading President Trump, drawn as a blind man wearing a skull cap. The cartoon was chosen from a syndication service by a production editor who did not recognize its anti-Semitism. How in the world are you a production editor then with the New York Times? Yet, however it came to be published, the appearance of such an obviously bigoted cartoon in a mainstream publication is evidence of a profound danger, not only of anti-Semitism, but of numbness to its creep, to the insidious way this ancient, enduring prejudice is once again working itself into public view and common conversation. Anti-Semitic imagery is particularly dangerous now. The number of assaults against American Jews more than doubled from 2017 to 2018, rising to 39, according to a report released Tuesday by the Anti-Defamation League. On Saturday, a gunman opened fire during Passover services at a synagogue in San Diego County, killing one person and injuring three. And by the way, the woman that was killed because she threw herself in front of the rabbis. He was about to be shot. He lost two fingers, or one severely and one partially. Allegedly, after he posted in an online manifesto that he wanted to murder Jews, for decades, most American Jews felt safe to practice their religion, but now they pass through metal detectors to enter synagogues and schools. Jews face even greater hostility and danger in Europe, where the cartoon was created. In Britain, one of several members of parliament who resigned from the Labour Party in February said that the party had become institutionally anti-Semitic. In France and Belgium, Jews have been the targets of terrorist attacks by Muslim extremists. Across Europe, right-wing parties with long histories of anti-Semitic rhetoric are gaining political strength. This is also a period of rising criticism of Israel, much of it directed at the rightward drift of its own government, and some of it even questioning Israel's very foundation as a Jewish state. We have been and remain stalwart supporters of Israel and believe that good faith criticism should work to strengthen it over the long term by helping it stay true to its democratic values. Yes, good faith criticism, I'm all for. But anti-Zionism can clearly serve as a cover for anti-Semitism, and some criticism of Israel, as the cartoon demonstrated, is couched openly in anti-Semitic terms. The responsibility for acts of hatred rests on the shoulders of the proponents and perpetrators, but history teaches that the rise of extremism requires the acquiescence of broader society. And we're going to come back to that in a minute. I want to read the rest of the editorial. But hear me. The only way that things like the Holocaust can take place is if the rest of society lets it happen. It's just like the line attributed to Francis Schaeffer about abortion, that every abortion clinic in America should have a sign saying open with permission of the local church. Jews get killed in society with permission of the local church. I'm talking about on a large scale, with the permission of the local church. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on The Line of Fire. Hey, remember, tomorrow is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, so all your Jewish-related questions, calls, issues, that's the day to call with those. Also, in an hour and 12 minutes, that's the plan, God willing. An hour and 12 minutes, so 4:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we'll be doing another exclusive YouTube chat. Maybe this is our fourth, maybe so far. So what we do on those chats is I may share a few things briefly, and then the whole time, half hour, 45 minutes, an hour, I will just answer your questions. I'll be watching them posted on YouTube, and I will answer them one after another. So that's a time to join us at Ask Dr. Brown on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our channel. When you do, as soon as we go live, then you'll know about it. Also, we've got some really exciting news about Patreon and what we're going to be doing on Patreon, how you can partner with us, and how you can benefit directly. Special things that will come to those on Patreon. And if you're one of our monthly supporters and torchbearers, we'll be writing you this month about how those benefits will automatically come your way as well. All right, so here's what the New York Times says. I'm going to skip down, all right? In the 1930s and the 1940s, so this is towards the end of the New York Times editorial. In the 1930s and the 1940s, the Times was largely silent as anti-Semitism rose up and bathed the world in blood. This has been an accusation, friends, that I've seen against the Times. I never researched this for myself, and obviously I wasn't around then to note this. But I've often heard it said that the New York Times was really lacking in its reporting during the Holocaust, all right? And you have to understand that the real reports were really not getting out. What was really happening, well, maybe it is it really happening, or as opposed to alerting the whole world to the madness of what was happening, to the sickening evil of what was happening. In the 1930s and the 1940s, the Times was largely silent as anti-Semitism rose up and bathed the world in blood. That failure still haunts this newspaper. Now, rightly, the Times has declared itself deeply sorry for the cartoon and called it unacceptable. Apologies are important, but the deeper obligation of the Times is to focus on leading through unblinking journalism and the clear editorial expression of its values. Society in recent years has shown healthy signs of increased sensitivity to other forms of bigotry, and yet somehow anti-Semitism can still be dismissed as a disease gnawing only at the fringes of society. That is a dangerous mistake. As recent events have shown, it is a very mainstream problem. Now, obviously, when they talk about other forms of bigotry, some things I'd agree with. We're more sensitive to racism than we may have been a generation ago. But if they say holding to biblical values about marriage and family and life is bigotry, well, I differ with the Times there. They end by saying, as the world once again contends with this age-old enemy, is not enough to refrain from empowering it. It is necessary to stand in opposition. All right, so New York Times apologizes. So there's an article on Vox.com, and it says this. And by the way, if I quote from a website, doesn't mean I agree with a website. We bring up news from all kinds of sites and discuss things. So many, probably most, I end up quoting from ones I differ with, just to mention that. All right. The New York Times' first article about Hitler's rise is absolutely stunning. This was sent to me today. It was by Zach Beauchamp, and it was updated March 3rd, 2016. All right. So it goes back over 3 years now. And it says this. On November 21st, 1922, the New York Times published its very first article about Adolf Hitler. It's an incredible read, especially its assertion that, quote, Hitler's anti-Semitism was not so violent or genuine as it sounded. This attitude was apparently widespread among Germans at the time. Many of them saw Hitler's anti-Semitism as a ploy for votes among the German masses. And I'm going to quote directly from the article. New York Times author said this, going back to decades and decades ago, almost 100 years ago. He, Hitler, is credibly credited with being actuated by lofty, unselfish patriotism. He probably does not know himself just what he wants to accomplish. The keynote of his propaganda is speaking and writing is violent anti-Semitism. His followers are nicknamed the Hakenkreuzler, which we'll come back to in a moment. So violent are Hitler's fulminations against the Jews that a number of prominent Jewish citizens are reported to have sought safe asylums in the Bavarian highlands, easily reached by fast motor cars where they could hurry their women and children when forewarned of an anti-Semitic St. Bartholomew's night. But several reliable, well-informed sources confirm the idea that Hitler's anti-Semitism was not so genuine or violent as it sounded, that it was merely using anti-Semitic propaganda as bait to catch masses of followers and to keep them aroused, enthusiastic, and in line for the time when his organization is perfected and sufficiently powerful to be employed effectively for political purposes. So, number one, you're talking about reading things incorrectly. Yeah, a lot of people say it's not really genuine or violent. It's just propaganda. But then the other question is, well, if that's what gets you votes, if that's what gets you support, oh my. Just picture, this is going to be very ugly what I say, just picture that I'm a white candidate in America, and the way that I can get votes is by calling for violence against blacks or Hispanics. I don't really mean it, but it's my way of getting votes. And people are going to vote for me. That's downplaying it. That's saying it's really not as bad as it says. I'm just using it to get votes. How sick. How evil. The article continues, a sophisticated politician credited Hitler with peculiar political cleverness for laying emphasis and overemphasis on anti-Semitism, saying, you can't expect the masses to understand or appreciate your finer real aims. You must feed the masses with cruder morsels and ideas like anti-Semitism. It would be politically all wrong to tell them the truth about where you're really leading them. Well, who do I want to lead? Do I want to lead the haters? Do I want to lead the people that want to kill the people they don't like? Do I want to rally them in my support? Or do I want to tell them, I don't want your vote. I don't want your support. I don't agree with you. I'm going to stand against your values. Look, there are white supremacists who voted for Trump that are deeply disappointed. He's a Jew lover. He's a Zionist. He's in the pocket of the Israelis and on and on. They're disappointed. They did not know who they were voting for in many respects. What's the definition of Hakenkreuzler? A member of any German-speaking organization in Europe after World War I using the swastika as an emblem of anti-Semitism or of extreme nationalist sentiment. You know what's so interesting? Is that if you'll go back and see, so this is March 2016, right? If you'll go back far enough and see the critiques of Trump, some on the left, and some are still saying it, is that it's a Nazi-like environment, and he's going to be raised up with Hitler-like power in America, and he's going to be responsible for a coup of power, bloodshed, or something like that. What's interesting is when it comes to religious liberties and protecting Christian values, we haven't had a stronger president. Obviously, far, 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 far from perfect. Obviously, well, I don't need to say that every time. We understand that. We haven't had a president standing more strongly with Israel. We haven't had a president standing more strongly for the unborn. By the way, I've got a new article up about that very subject, President Trump's comments about infanticide, that the left is saying it's not true, he's lying, he's creating this hysteria over. So, no, it's true. What he says is true. What he says is accurate. And do you know that most recent stats from the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, most recent government stats indicate that, was it 2015? Most recent stats released that in New York City, there were 385 homicides, thereabouts. Babies aborted after 21 weeks, almost 1,500. Almost 1,500. Yeah. In any case, we just jump from one thing to another, but they're all related. Let us have our eyes open, friends. Let us have our eyes open. Those of you who knew me for years, and back in 2004, I started addressing issues having to do with gay activism. You're thinking, Mike Brown, what are you talking about, man? Where are you getting into that? You're called to reach Jewish people with the gospel. You're called to teach the word. You're called to stir the church for revival. You're called to take the gospel to the nations. Why this? Well, I saw early on, that it was the principal threat, and it's not through my insight, through reading and studying, looking at what others had seen, and from the Holy Spirit speaking to my heart, that this was now the principal threat to freedom of religion, speech, and conscience in America. Now, you can't go a second of a day without this being somewhere in the news, or somewhere in your kid's school, or somewhere in a court, or somewhere in a church, or coming up somewhere, or a family member dealing with a real issue needs help. There's a reason we address things, friends. I am Mr. Optimist. I am full of faith and confidence, and I believe we're going to turn the tide in many ways in our nation. I believe that with all my heart. But it's going to be as we wake up. It's going to be as we stand together. All right, before the end of the broadcast, I want to tell you a little bit more about what benefits will come your way as a Patreon subscriber, and how you'll be helping us. I'll do that before the show is out. 1 hour from now, our live YouTube chat. But next, I'm going to speak with Denise Schick. She has an amazing story to tell and an amazing new book. Stay right there. Came to work.
fire we
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Friends, I haven't written on this yet or talked about it on the radio, but in Canada, a shocking case where parents not happy with their daughter's desire to transgender to transition into male and take hormones, etc. They have fought against her doing this. The father has referred to her as she is. And the courts have not only said the parents cannot interfere with her choices, she is a minor living at home, but if the father refers to her incorrectly, whether it's a boy, girl, if he will be fine. He is not allowed to refer to his child according to its biological sex. You're talking about transgender activism totally out of control. What happens when things hit your own home? What happens when it's the thing we don't hear about so much, when it's your parent? Here it's your child. What happens when it's your parent? Denise Schick lived through this. She has a book, When Daddy Leaves to Be a Girl. It's a children's book written by Denise and illustrated by Yana Popova and Julie Howard, written for children and helping them address these issues. Nothing like this has been done, but it's really important. Denise, thanks so much for joining us again on The Line of Fire.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
So let's talk about your own background. First, you lived through this. How old were you when your daddy confided his secret in you, and how did it affect you?
I was 9 years old when he had told me of his desire to become a woman. And it impacted my world more deeply than what I really thought that it would that specific day. I thought, Dad is Dad and I'm Denise. We're two separate people. This will not affect me. And I was very naive, very much with a child's mind, you know, not realizing the maturity as an adult of how it did affect me. I immediately felt the loss of a father. In my heart, it was as if he did not want to exist. He didn't exist. And grieving the loss of that father, grieving the loss of dreams that I had of having my dad, and in the future even, you know, what that looked like as I was preparing for my wedding or later in years, just always having a father. So it really brought a lot of sorrow, a lot of sadness to me immediately.
Yeah, and why did your father feel he needed to do this? I mean, 9-year-old daughter, why? What was he thinking? And obviously, you had years to look at this and talk about it. What was he thinking?
Yeah, I don't know. I honestly don't know. In fact, I didn't know that specific day either, Dr. Brown. I sat there in the grass with him behind our house as he had shared with me this desire and many other sort of details of his life. And I sat there at 9 years old thinking, why is he telling me this? I am just a kid.
Yeah. So
it didn't make sense.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. A father wants to talk to his daughter, but one thing parents do is they protect their kids. You know, if you're having financial problems, you don't tell your kids, you know, you protect them from this. If there are other issues, that's what parents do. They shelter their kids as opposed to unburden themselves to a little child that doesn't have the capacity to understand. Let me turn this around for a moment, and then I want to talk about your book, why you wrote it, who you wrote it for. I was sent a video clip of a woman, and she is playing with, looks like a little girl in the yard, so happy and all this. And she's a Christian woman and raising her son and finds out that the son, little boy, believes he's a girl. And he actually prays for the little boy to go away. You know, he wants the little boy to die. And when she kind of accepts this and then recognizes he really is a girl on the inside and embraces it, now happy child and happy mother and challenged her faith, etc. So we're dealing with really difficult life situations here. What would you say to a mother like that? Because she wants to do what's best for her kid, and she's trying to honor God. What would you say to a mom like that, Denise?
I would really say to them, first of all, not to turn your back on God, or God did not make a mistake in your child being male or female biologically, to see what is really going on in the heart of that child. Usually, this isn't just where they wake up one day and I want to be a girl or I want to be a boy. It's something that's manifested for some time, even as a child. So to realize that at the heart of this very difficult and sensitive topic here, that there are reasons, you know, after being in ministry for 16 years and living through this personally, there's not somebody that I haven't met that there aren't reasons that have brought this idealism into their life, that they are going to be happier being somebody else, that this other way of life is going to bring them that true happiness, or where they're feeling more confident about themselves. We have to look at the issues of the heart.
Mm. So what would be, from your experience, having spoken to many people, and friends, Denise has a website, helpforfamilies.com. I give it out all the time when folks are inquiring about transgender issues. It's number four, helpforfamilies.com. What might be one issue that you've seen where a child, we're not talking about an 18-year-old or 16-year-old been exposed to social media or reality TV or agendas in the school. We're talking about, you know, a four-year-old kid, maybe, five-year-old kid. What might be a reason that the child would be confused about their gender and sex?
They might feel that way because they feel like mom or dad would be happier with a son or a daughter.
Mm.
That's one of the things that people have talked about that they've struggled with, that they always thought that dad wanted a son, and therefore they thought that they could be that boy, you know, vice versa with the girls. So as silly as that may sound to some folks that don't understand this, it's real.
So interesting. So, I mean, that's just one thing you're throwing out, obviously.
One thing that I'm throwing out, you know.
Right.
But there are many others, of course.
Yeah, but it is interesting that I think of Walt Heyer's story. He may be the best known spokesperson today of someone that had sex change surgery only to come and regret it and then seek to reverse it, and now at peace with the Lord and now married happily to a wife for years now. But he talks about how his grandmother used to dress him up in a dress, and that he got a lot of approval when he was put in a dress, and that was something that just stayed with him. You never know.
Right.
It's not like you're being a bad parent. It's just, rather than put the kid on hormone blockers before they come into puberty, rather than have the kid go through sex change surgery and then hormones for life, there are better ways to address this that are even more compassionate. So the book, When Daddy Leaves to Be a Girl, why did you write it? Who did you write it for?
I actually wrote it after hearing from moms for over 3 years asking for a resource for their children, that there wasn't a ministering tool out there when they are dealing with the loss of a parent, mainly fathers. And so it was listening to the pleas of moms that were saying we need something for our children, and to realize this was the most difficult project that I have ever worked on. In so many ways, but it was so needed. I have heard from moms across the U.S. that have said, my child's got this cage bolted because it's where he or she, you know, can relate to what you're saying here on a specific, maybe it was the anger, maybe it was, you know, the grief, the confusion, all of that. But I wanted the child in this book that would read this book for it to be therapeutic for them, and walking them through my journey of understanding that God is with them, that they are not in this alone, and to be able to give them practical advice, you know, for walking them through this to hopefully where it would be a starting tool for their own healing.
And friends, I think the first children's book I was asked to write an endorsement for. I don't get a lot of requests for that, and I jumped at the opportunity, and the book is endorsed by biblical scholars, by pastors, by those involved in ministry to help those with unwanted same-sex attraction and gender identity confusion, When Daddy Leaves to Be a Girl. By the way, when you get the book, post a review on Amazon. Thankfully, it's been free from negative reviews, attacking, because that's what normally happens. But once more attention comes out to the book, people who haven't read it will attack and try to disparage. But what age group are you especially targeting, Denise?
We are targeting 5 to 8 year olds.
Okay, so let's go through it. Tell me the story. I've got the book here. It's attractively illustrated for kids those age. And again, Denise, you lived through this yourself. Do you have a favorite memory of your daddy? I do. One day my daddy asked me to put my feet on top of his shoes and dance with him. He held me tight. I felt like a princess. You start there. Now, how does the story unfold?
The story starts to unfold with my dad asking for me to go outside and to sit with him, where my whole life had changed. Walking through what my thoughts were that day, how I was confused, the grief that I started to feel of losing my father at that time. And talking about, you know, just honestly the grief, the confusion, even on my own identity. Because if God made a mistake with my dad, my emotions started to tell me, and my brain and everything through this experience, then maybe God made a mistake with me too. How do I know that I am really supposed to be a girl? And so we're talking about the confusion of how that can enter into the child's mind. You know, what's it feel like when you hear about your daddy wearing a wig or a dress and somebody has seen him in town, or somebody that has mentioned something to you, or somebody in the family? You know, there's that embarrassment, shame sometimes that's attached to it. And so you start to hide the fact of what's going on in your home. And so to walk the child through all of these different emotions is really important as they start to unravel their true feelings and thoughts. And to end this in a way where they start to look at Father God, you know, and I remember doing that so often, Dr. Brown. I would be outside, you know, I would be glue, a summer day, a winter day, whatever, and I would say to God so many times, I don't know why this is happening to my family, but I know you're with me. And so for children, no matter what the situation they're facing, no matter how desperate they're feeling, that they be able to rely on God to help them.
Amen. All right, we'll be right back. I want to talk to Denise Chick about regrets people have. Who've had sex change surgery. The book, When Daddy Leaves to Be a Girl.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I'm speaking with Denise Chick. Just want to grab a few more minutes with her. Her book, When Daddy Leaves to Be a Girl, it's written especially for children aged 5 to 8. But of course, parents read it first, digest the contents. Her website, help4families.com. So Denise, you've interacted with many people who have identified as opposite of their biological sex, dressed that way, lived that way, maybe were on hormones, maybe actually had sex change surgery. Walt Heyer has a whole website with testimonies of people with sex change regret. What are some of the regrets you've heard? What are some of the personal stories you've heard?
You know, some of the regrets that I hear, and it's so sad, is when somebody realizes that later in their late 50s or in their 60s, and to come to a point to say, what have I done with my life? You know, it's so sad because none of us can regain years of our youth back.
Yeah.
And to realize that a mistake, that they had made a mistake by using the sex reassignment surgery, the hormones, the testosterone, all of the identity, all of this to mask the real pain that's deep down.
Yeah. So you're talking about living your life in a way that you regret, not just a decision, I said the wrong thing, or I wish I hadn't done this, but living your life a certain way that brings regret. What do you see as
right.
the long-term effects of the the transgender revolution now, you know, with boys competing on girls' sports teams and things like that, and college campuses having men's bathrooms with tampons because men menstruate. And what do you see as long-term societal effects?
I think we're going to continue to see a breakdown of the family. There's going to be further destruction among family members, and I mean emotionally, when you've got family splitting over those that are supporting, you know, the loved one and those that aren't, and oh my goodness, some of the really sad situations that family members face in society when we have people that are identifying as transgender and going to school to be elementary teachers, counselors, things of that nature, occupations like that. You know, I thought today as I was reading a story, what happens to the child that may confess to the teacher without knowing they're transgender, that their parent's transitioning? And what kind of empathy is that child going to receive? What kind of counseling is that child going to receive? But we're forgetting that there's so many more involved besides the loved one, and how this is destroying and just destruction in society at so many different levels. I honestly can tell you that I, for one, never thought that I would be living today to see what I'm seeing in it's on such a fast train in society. Girls that are biologically girls should be able to compete with other females, not go up against somebody that's biologically built stronger.
Yeah, so they're even feminists now, raising their voices against this, and because they're realizing that everything they fought for with, quote, women's rights — I say quote women's rights because some is women's rights and some goes beyond it with radical feminism — but everything they fought for years is being undone by someone saying, well, I'm biologically male, but now I identify as female. And they're like, you never were female, and you aren't female. So it's interesting to see where some of the opposition is coming from. Last question, Denise. We're talking about issues in society, but we're also talking about people. And I don't think anyone wishes this on themselves, especially a child. So people go through a lot of pain. People go through a lot of heartache. Families wrestle with things. If you're watching or listening now and you identify as transgender, I can't relate to what you're going through. I can't relate to struggles and pain you've endured. So I don't speak with a callous attitude. These are weighty, weighty issues affecting human beings loved by God. So how should the church respond to the transgender community?
I think, first of all, that the best way to respond is to respond as you would anybody, you know, which hopefully somebody that's a prostitute that walks into your church, you show compassion, you show love towards mm-hmm. that person. Somebody that's an alcoholic, sometimes we can get too tied up with the label transgender, and it can panic us. We can run in fear of not wanting to touch the person, not to invest in that person.
Yeah.
But if they come into the church and they're honestly seeking God, they deserve the same opportunity that any of the rest of us sinners have had. And so, you know, my advice to the church is please don't fear them. You know, understand that most of them, or I'd say all of them that I've ever known or met through my life, there's a lot of hurt and pain. And so they need to know that God as their personal healer, you know, and what he can take them through, that this isn't a light switch where they turn on these feelings and to expect them 6 hours later, you know, to be walking in that original maleness or femaleness. They have to be willing to get down and dirty and into the pain of the person.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. First, treat them like everybody else, fellow human being that needs love and compassion and truth. And then second, get involved in their lives and don't just reject based on outward appearance. And someone may even test your sincerity by even being more blatant to see if you'll meet them where they are. Hey, Denise, so many need you to keep doing what you're doing. Your story is redemptive. You could have been a victim. Instead, you've turned this around in a way that's redemptive. And the book for children, the only thing I know like it, When Daddy Leaves to Be a Girl, written by Denise Schick. Again, her website, help4families.com. Hey, thanks so much, Denise, for all your hard work. Stay with it.
Thank you.
God bless. All right, friends. So I've got a special announcement for you. Special announcement for you. Many of you want to help us, stand with us, and you say, I'd love to be a torchbearer and get the benefits of that, but that's $30 or more per month. I really can't do that, but I love what you're doing. I love the videos you're putting on YouTube and literally around the world, wherever we go, I watch your YouTube videos. I'm walking through the airport yesterday, and there's an airline worker there. He comes running over to me. He's also a part-time professor and doing apologetics, et cetera. He comes running over to me and, hey, I watch your videos, and we got to chat for a little while. So by God's grace, we're reaching people. By God's grace, the word is getting out, and we are swirled with controversy around us day and night. People learning, people being changed, people being helped, people being blessed, and others attacking left and right. Here, I'll just share this with you. All right, this testimony here. I think I've got it somewhere. Let's see here. You just got this the other day, and then I'm gonna tell you the good news here. Here we go. She writes just this week. No, sorry. She writes, keep speaking truth. I, too, was sucked into the YouTube anti-Jew, quote, Christian videos. I brought those ideas to my husband, and he gently rebuked me for being anti-Semitic. She says this, I was hurt, and God, something just jumped on my screen here. Come on, how does that happen? I was hurt and confused, so I asked God to show me what was the truth. YouTube then recommended your videos about, is Jesus kosher? It was life-changing finding your YouTube channel. Thank you, Dr. Brown. So here's how you can help and directly benefit yourself. $10 a month, you can become a Patreon patron. You can be one of those who helps underwrite, support our production of new videos, life-changing videos that you know what we've done thus far, and we're just getting started. Almost 1,700 videos already, and a massive resource there, and much more to come by God's grace and with your help. So $10 or more per month, and here's what you get. Not only, biggest thing you get is you're sharing the reward with us. The biggest thing you get is the smile of the Father and knowing that lives are being changed. That's the biggest thing. But here's how we also benefit you. Every week, we're preparing a new bonus show for you. The first one already is up. It's personal things I learned about how to study the Word of God with some funny stories along the way. Next one I did, how to have a happy marriage. And if you're single, how to relate in these ways. So every week, there's going to be a new bonus show that will only be available to our Patreon supporters, or our torchbearers will get that benefit as well. But just $10 a month. And so a new bonus show every day, every week. Plus, we're doing YouTube chats at least one a week. And as soon as the chat's done, it's offline. All right, so we do it, we answer questions, we interact with people, and then it's offline. As a Patreon supporter, you'll get to watch that as well. So it's pennies for the broadcast, but you're helping us. It matters to us. Hopefully $10, a few cents every day is something that you can manage. But if you do it, it'll make a big difference to us and enable us to put out videos that require more work, more effort. Look, there's some real junk on the internet, some dangerous junk, some really bad stuff that literally millions of people have watched. And people keep saying, Dr. Brown, when are you going to refute that? When are you going to do a series on that? Well, it takes time. It takes energy. It takes staff. It means we have to break away from doing other things to devote time and energy or not travel out and speak so as we can have weekends to record. That means that we need to generate more funds to do that, because when I travel and speak, we receive offerings that help our ministry, that pay the bills so we can bring these messages to you. So $10 a month, join us. Here's where you go. Patreon.com/AskDr. Brown, A-S-K-D-R Brown. Be one of our first. Come on, that's history. Our first 100, our first 1,000, it's going to be special. Patreon.com/AskDr. Brown. Ask Dr. Brown. Join us there today. If you're a torchbearer, you want to become a Patreon supporter as well, great. But as a monthly supporter, torchbearer, we'll give you the Patreon benefits as well. We'll add those to you. All right, friends, 30 minutes from now, I'll be doing a YouTube chat on the Ask Dr. Brown YouTube channel. God bless you.